You'll be happy to know something. You have basically learned most of what you need to learn. You essentially know what you need to know now, at least as far as the principal structures are concerned. We have essentially covered all of the important forms, and from now on, what we're going to do is essentially see how they're used. In other words, these are, you can think of them as basic building blocks, and what we're going to do now is, from now on, essentially is see how composers use these building blocks, how they put them together in different ways, especially sonata form. We're going to take a lot of time with sonata form. In fact, today, rather than doing a lot of other things, essentially what we're going to do is listen to several pieces and movements that are in sonata form and see how, in this case, it'll be Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven use this form and the many, many permutations that are possible because of it. It's a, as you probably surmised from last week, it's a pretty sophisticated structure, and it allows a great deal of flexibility. I mean, the fact that Haydn wrote 104 symphonies, that Mozart wrote about 50, plus innumerable string quartets, concertos, sonatas, many, many other pieces, and practically every one of them uses sonata form, and no two are alike. That begins to tell you just what's possible. So, do you remember sonata form from last time? Okay. Just keep in mind you have the three sections: exposition, development, recapitulation. Of course, that's on that sheet. And what I'll be putting up here is really not too much beyond what's on the sheet. And then you have the two groups. And don't forget the tonal dimension, because that's really what at least classical sonata form is all about. And we start, think of our tonal drama. We start in the tonic here, which we'll call 1, and then we move somewhere else, usually to 5, which is the dominant, or sometimes some other place. Then we go off into all kinds of wild and unusual modulations throughout the development, and then at the end of the development, we reestablish order and come back to the tonic, and the recapitulation stays in the tonic. I mentioned that last week. If you were here last week, there was a typo on your sheet which has been corrected. So if you just picked up a sheet today, you have the correct version. But keep in mind the recapitulation does stay in the tonic. Now, have I mentioned, I think I have, the fact if we're talking the classic era, that is from roughly the, or somewhere in the mid to latter part of the 18th century into the very early part of the 19th century, we have essentially three composers that we'll be talking about. There are many, many, but the two main composers are Haydn and Mozart. I think we mentioned that they both lived in Vienna at about the same time, and really their careers are essentially contemporary, even though Haydn is 25 years older or 24 years older than Mozart. It's just that Haydn was a sort of one of these late bloomers, and Mozart sort of came out of the womb making music almost. He was an incredible child prodigy. And they both respected each other, and they both learned from each other. And of course, Beethoven comes along a little bit later, at the very end of the classic era, and we will listen to some Beethoven today. Fairly early Beethoven, are getting into what we might call middle Beethoven. So these are the composers we'll deal with. I thought we'd start first with a symphony of Haydn, the very last symphony that he wrote, which is number 104. This is sometimes referred to as the London Symphony because he wrote it to be performed when he was in London as a visiting superstar, in a sense, was essentially what the situation was. That's a little bit confusing because he wrote the last 12 symphonies in London, and sometimes the last 12 symphonies are called the London Symphonies. But anyway, it's just a bit of ambiguity. Now, the first movement is fairly straightforward sonata form. There's one wrinkle, though, that it has that we haven't mentioned so far. At least the sonata forms we've listened to have not had this. The first movement, if you remember from way back, is going to be fast, because we have that pattern of fast, slow, fast, and frequently a dance movement added as either the second or third movement. But Haydn and Mozart both, in their late symphonies, and this doesn't occur very often except in the symphonies. In one or two other cases it does, like string quartets, but would often add a big introduction before the actual sonata form started, and this introduction would be slow. So you would have a slow introduction, and then you would have the body of the movement, which, as I say, is pretty straightforward as far as sonata form is concerned. And you usually don't have, there's no problem telling the difference, because the introduction, it's, first of all, it's, you know, it's quite slow. In this case, it's quite, in a sense, majestic. At least it starts off with a big fanfare. And once the allegro starts, the fast part starts, you can, you know, it's very obvious that this material at the beginning is clearly introductory. It's not like a separate movement or anything else. He's just sort of, in some cases, it's sometimes referred to as an audience silencer. That is, you know, you have this big chord or something at the beginning just to get everybody quiet and focused on the music, and then it starts. It's actually more than that. In this case, it's a fairly extensive introduction. So what I think I'll do is just play straight through the first movement, and I'll point out where we are as it unfolds, and I think that all you need to do essentially is listen and follow. By the way, is one of the most extensive introductions of any Haydn symphony. Finally, group one. cadence. Group two. Close to the end of the exposition. Where are we? He's repeating in this case, right? Group two. Development. That's pretty clear, isn't it? No question about that one. This is the end of group one. There's group two. Was it easy to follow? Yeah. That one's a pretty clear example, I think. Certainly he gives you that big pauses at the right place, which is really convenient. There are two or three things going on in this particular movement, though, that I think are worth commenting about. First of all, I don't know if you noticed this. How many noticed the main theme of the second group as compared to the main theme of the first group? The main theme of the first group was bee-dee-da-dum, ba-lum-bum-bum-bum-ba-dum. And what was the main theme that started the second group? It was exactly the same. I think I heard somebody say the same. It was exactly the same, at least at the beginning, not continuous. In other words, the first group started. Now, what did the second group sound like? It's going to be the same theme, but it's not going to sound exactly the same because he's moved to a different key. The second group was, which is basically the same thing. The only difference was that change of key. He moves up five notes to be in the dominant. Now, is this significant as far as sonata form is concerned? No, not really. One of the reasons I mentioned this is that this is why we use the words group one and group two rather than theme one and theme two, because that would be very confusing if we referred to it as theme one and theme two. Besides, there are a lot of other themes in there. It's just that he used the same theme to start each group with. Then he went on to other themes and other tunes, basically. So in this case, it doesn't, as far as classic sonata form is concerned, it doesn't matter how many themes you have or how they're arranged, whether they're the same here or different there. What really matters is the way these keys are handled and then what happens in the development. Now, that theme that I just played, which is, and then it goes on after that. If you listen closely to the development, it's an interesting development because practically every measure, what Haydn does, he takes one motive from that theme, that motive, and he repeats that in almost every measure of the development section. What he does, he sort of latches on to a little motive from the theme. And when we use the word motive in music, that's what we mean, just the smallest fragment that makes any sense. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-dum, it would be a motive. It wouldn't be a whole theme. And you couldn't break it down much further, because if you go ba-ba-ba-da-dum, you know, it begins to lose any sort of coherence at all. But you can hear that, da-da-da-da-da-dum, as an entity. And what Haydn does in this case is to use that one motive throughout the development. Now, he uses a lot of other themes and so forth, not just that one. But if you were to listen closely, if next time you hear this, or if you have a CD of it or whatever, when you get to the development, listen for that. Sometimes it's not always obvious, because sometimes the tune will be up in the melody, but sometimes something else will be going on in the melody, and it'll be going on down in the bass or someplace like that. But it's, and there's a few measures that it's not there. Or sometimes it'll be sort of dressed up and ornamented a little, da-da-da-da-dee-da-da-da-da-dum, something like that. But it's essentially that same thing that's there. And that also brings up one other subject, which you may be interested in, if we want to get really sophisticated. By now, you're probably beginning to be familiar with classic period music. In other words, what this music of Mozart and Haydn sounds like, because most of the examples have been, or practically all of them, have been from that period. How do you tell the difference between Haydn and Mozart? Now, there's a tricky one. Actually, you can. This is a very typical Haydn symphony. It would not be typical of Mozart. Now, I don't expect you to go out of here and be able to, every time you hear something on the radio, identify whether it's Haydn or Mozart. That's not the point of this. But what's interesting is that the two of them are taking essentially the same materials and handling it in a slightly different way. The very fact that the first group and the second group began with the same theme as one of the main clues. And the fact that Haydn latched onto one motive and used it throughout the development is another. What Haydn likes to do is take a few themes or motives and work them over, basically. In other words, lots of elaboration and development and things like that. What Mozart likes to do is string a lot of different themes together. And so when you hear Mozart, you'll hear just one tune after another, usually. But when you hear Haydn, this, and these are tendencies, obviously, that you know you can't say this is absolute in every piece, but when you hear Haydn, you more often hear what you heard right here. That is, taking a few ideas and then using it over and over, manipulating it, developing it in various ways. And there's one other difference, which will be a little bit more obvious in the next example I'm going to play. It's a little bit apparent here, but not too much. Haydn tended to use something closer to what we might call European or Austrian folk music at the time. There's a folk quality in a lot of Haydn's music that you don't find so much in Mozart's music. Now, Mozart certainly used folk tunes, or something resembling folk tunes. I'm not going to say he used folk tunes, but Haydn, it tends to be, especially in sonata, big sonata form movements, it tends to be a little bit stronger and more apparent. And like I say, in the next example, I think that will be clearer.